All right, so welcome. So I'll be teaching this month, and we'll do some talks alternating with discussion nights. And I wanted tonight to talk about the worry mind, the mind of worry. And I intentionally use that kind of grammar because when we think of the worried mind, we kind of automatically go into I am worried, you know, and what am I worried about? So it quickly takes us from this state that I want us to focus on of worry itself into the object of what we're worried about or the sense of identity that who we are giving birth to as a worried person. And also I entitled this A Gateway to the Dharma. So we'll use these mind states. We'll talk about worry tonight, and next 2 weeks from now we'll talk about the busy mind and the wanting mind. These are very common states that we struggle with in our culture, in our society. And they come up often in interviews. People talk about how my mind is so worried, so caught with anxiety, worrying about my family, worrying about the election, worrying about whatever it might be. And yet, those, if you look at it the right way, those states become an actual gateway into the Dharma. So I like to approach that from that spirit, that theme. So the sense of worry has such a strong projection into the future. What will the future hold for myself, for my loved ones, for the country, for the world? And when you've been caught in worry, you know how gripping it can be. It becomes almost all-encompassing. There's nothing that can get outside of that because it's so gripping, it's so strong. In our emotions trigger our hormones. So there's this whole chemical sea that we swim in, and our thoughts continue to get more worry thoughts, more obsessive thoughts, and it just becomes this big spiral of dukkha, really. And not to discount that we have significant situations, real situations that we have to often figure out and address, you know, whether it's our personal or family, or something much bigger than that. You know, not to dismiss those, but to kind of question how much time do we spend obsessing over it versus actually really connecting with what needs to be done. And I thought this would be a timely discussion with the election next Tuesday. The polls are different than they used to be. And as meditators, we also realize, though, that this pattern of worry is very thought-based. And we start to learn not to trust our thoughts so much, to suspend our belief, our conviction in thoughts. And this is already the start to the gateway into these patterns. Freud apparently said that about 25% of our suffering is stuff we can't change in our life. It's things like getting old, getting sick, loss. The other 75% of suffering is worrying about that first 25%. So it's that 75% of worrying about stuff we can't change that we want to explore. Another novel from 1883, apparently, An American in Foreign Hand in Britain. There's a little paragraph. A good story was told of an old man who had endured many of the ills of life in his long journey. His friends, upon one occasion, more trying than usual, condoled him with him, saying that he really had more troubles than other men. And the man said, "Yes, my friends, that is too true. I have been surrounded by troubles all my life long. But there's a curious thing about them. 9/10 of them never happened." Yeah, so how often do we worry about things that never actually arise? You know, how much suffering is really embedded in that pattern? So why is worry a gateway? You know, this state of mind is so unpleasant, it's so difficult. You know, there's so much really dukkha that comes up around this. It's often a question that comes up in interviews. And there's a danger of us using our practice to try to get rid of this pattern. Because if I learn how to connect with my breath, I learn how to steady my mind, the worry starts to fall away. And I think, okay, that's why I practice, to get rid of the worry, or perhaps to kind of self-soothe the anxiety that comes up. If we approach our practice from that way, without this deeper perspective of why we really practice, that is of awakening, it distorts the whole thing. So if we practice with this sense of getting rid of worry, getting rid of, to self-soothe, to improve ourselves, it doesn't lead toward awakening. It's not really part of the Eightfold Path. It's not aligned with right view. Well, if we practice to awaken, if we practice to understand a very deep, unshakable liberation of mind and of heart, if that's the intent of our practice, the side effect is that worry falls away. And this, it's a side effect instead of the main focus. And it actually leads to a much more unshakable peace if we have that intentionality, because we've established wise view with this understanding of the Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path. You know, why do we actually practice? This is one of the key differences between secular Buddhism and Dharma. It's very perspective about why we practice. So when we get caught in worry, again, it's such a gripping pattern. You know, I've worked with worry the last few years for different conditions, different situations. And it could, just like you're in these, this, almost the whole world closes around this one thing and just keep thinking over and over again about it. And if there's a willingness, though, to turn to, in the middle of that, to actually turn toward that pattern, now with a sense of trying to get rid of it or trying to fix what you're worried about, but actually go right into the middle of that pattern, there's a deep growth that is there, great potential for growth, for understanding. To do this, we need to, for a while at least, release the object of our worry, the object of what we're concerned about, obsessed about. This isn't about throwing out action. It's not about becoming passive. But it's learning this sense of this 9/10 of our life that we worry about things instead of the actual things that happen. By throwing out by releasing the need to act, the need to resolve it for the moment, allows us to actually meet that experience in a different way. Because actually the need to act, the urge to act, is really embedded in worry. And we actually continue to build up that snowball of concern. And then when something is right in front of us, when there's something that we have to deal with, then we bring our full attention to it. And without being so distorted by worry, by reactivity, we're able to see what's really the next right action in this moment. What's the next clear step? And then that step will have a response, a reaction. Then we have to come up with the next step. So really, that kind of planning doesn't take that much time, that much energy. But how often do you come up with a plan and then you rehash it? You go over and over again, the obsessive quality of that. At what point does it become obsession? The real worry is when this sense of fear and emotionality and thoughts start to take over, start to breathe their own life. We try to figure out every possible variation. You know, and how often does that really prove to be accurate? When we plan this whole scenario and we actually go through that situation, it's completely different than we thought. So this practice is learning to be much more spontaneous and responsive to life, to not be so driven by our ideas of how life should be, how we fear it might be, how life has been in the past, but to actually show up each moment to see how that is. You know, in relationships, it's one of the challenging things. When you've been in a relationship for a while, you stop seeing that person for who they are. You can have this memory of all the past interactions, but to actually see them fresh, actually meet them with a fresh eye for ourselves. You know, can I meet myself in this moment? What's the really connected manifestation of myself in this moment? Not based on all the things I should do or shouldn't do, my self-beliefs. So when we get caught in worry, it's a manifestation of that locking ourselves into a prison. prison of our own mind. The good news is it is just a thought and just a belief that there is a great potential for releasing that and the freedom that comes from that release. Now, if you look at worry in terms of classic Buddhist list, we can pull it out from the five hindrances, usually called restlessness and worry, or sometimes restlessness and remorse. So when hindrances are active in our mind and body, when they're present, there's a couple of things that happen. I think it's helpful to look at from the suttas. One is that mind becomes more brittle. It becomes less malleable. It's like it becomes stiff. It's not so easy to adjust. You know, so when we're caught in worry, we're really living in our thoughts and our assumptions of how things will be, instead of actually having this pliability of seeing how is the moment arising. So this isn't a new concept. If you think about it, when you practice meditation, the instructions are to notice the breath. Notice the simple rising of the breath and the falling away of the breath without it changing or adjusting it. Sometimes as we learn to practice, we're trying to control the breath, making it short or long or concerned about that. But at some point, we just allow the breath to breathe itself. And we're simply observing that breath arising and falling. And then that translates out into body sensations. Okay, there's an ache, there's a tingling, there's a warmth. All those are felt without any kind of influence, just totally noticing it. At that point, the mind is very pliable. It's very much connected to that without trying to influence it or change it. It's an embrace of that moment's experience. It's really an expression of love, a complete acceptance. And then we start to open up to being aware of thought, aware of emotions. And those, because they have more of a charge, our mindfulness sometimes starts to get a little more shaky, not quite so pliable, not quite so malleable. It starts to have a certain agenda or pushing as we come into thoughts about ourselves, our beliefs, our emotionalities, things that we judge more deeply, more personally. But that's just because the object has a certain charge, a certain identification with that. All right? So then as we learn to bring that mindfulness quality to that, then it becomes much more pliable again. So when worry arises as a hindrance, it does create this sense of brittleness, a sense of rigidity to whatever's arising. It really paints the whole of our experience from that. I mean, it's hard to hear other things when we're caught in worry. Another analogy the Buddha used for the hindrances is having a bowl of water, that if it's clear, you can look at your reflection and see it very clearly. You can clearly see what you look like in that moment. But the hindrances have an effect of distorting that water. An analogy he used for this hindrance of restlessness and worry is that the water is rippled like with a wave, with a wind. So it has little ripplets, little waves. So you can imagine trying to look at a reflection that has all these little waves on it. Your face will be very distorted. And so too, when we look out in the world, when we're caught in the hindrance like worry, the whole world becomes distorted. All our sense gates get distorted by that. Because this practice, one way to frame it is learning how to see clearly, to actually see very freshly. In the suttas, Buddha often talked about the dust, removing the dust from someone's eyes. That person had little dust in their eyes, or that person had a lot of dust in their eyes. And that sense of being able to see really how is life without the overlay of our past assumptions, past expectations, without the overlay of our future fears and worries. How is life actually showing up in this moment? Just in this moment. So often when we talk about coming back to the moment, there's a sense of, well, what about these issues, these real issues I have to deal with? You know, what about this and that? And there's a huge concerns. And yet, at the same time, unless we learn how to connect with the moment just as it is, any action that we do will become distorted by that reactivity, be distorted by worry. And when the hindrances fall away, the Buddha also talked about, it's like this current of our attention, of our practice, becomes very straight and pure without being drawn away by side currents or by canals. There's a sense of really unifying our attention. And when that unifies toward awakening, there's a huge amount of energy that starts to become freed and focused on that. Everything that arises in our life becomes an opportunity to look at, to understand, how do I show up? How do I form in relationship to this thing arising? So let's look at worry a little bit more. So it's an interesting thing with worry is that there's so many different things we worry about. We could probably take a little survey and some people would have, okay, I'm worried about this issue, I'm worried about this issue, and it wouldn't all line up. It's because each one of us, our worries are conditioned by our past, by our family, or by our culture, you know, by our education, you know, our environment, things we've grown up, things we've experienced, traumas, prejudice, all these different things come in and create different elements that we worry about. And often, you know, have a very valid base in that. But it's this obsessive part that we're really looking at. I remember talking to two men back to back privately. So when I was talking to one man, he was just really concerned about, there's another election time coming up. He's like, well, if this side wins, I'm really concerned what's going to happen to our children. He happened to be very conservative. The next person was very liberal. He says, I'm really concerned if the other side wins, what's going to happen to the children? Right? So there's interesting, they're both unified around this concern for the children. Had completely different expressions of that worry. So part of understanding our job really as meditators is to understand the conditions that give rise to our own patterns of worry. The good news is that we don't have an inexhaustible supply. We have a certain level of conditions that we've already established since childhood. And there's certain common themes that we go through. And so when we start to understand them and learn them and recognize them, then we're no longer being so driven by them. If we recognize them completely, understand them completely, then there's a freedom that comes from that. So that's the good news. There's only a limited number you need to understand. The bad news is you have to understand it for yourself. You can hear someone talk about it, but until you actually go into the middle of these patterns and really see them fall away, it won't be yours. It won't be yours to see, to understand. Now, conditions are interesting. It's like have you ever tried to start like a campfire in the weather like this, when everything's been soaked and just raining? It's very, very difficult. But you take that same environment, put it in the middle of the summer, and you have like a beer bottle or a wine bottle. The sun hits that light just right, you can start a raging forest fire. Okay? It's because the conditions are different one time versus another. So when the conditions line up, we become very susceptible for worry to arise, to be seen, to really be kind of a forest fire through our mind and body. So that's also important to realize there's a certain unpersonal nature to it, that because of our past history, our past conditioning, the way we form ourselves around different issues, we're more susceptible to worry to come up in a particular area versus another one. One of the key conditions for worry is our belief in thought. Our belief in thought. The more we believe in our thinking as being true, as being significant, having a weight, the more we're going to worry. You know, you can go through the day and have this random thought come about, and before that, you weren't even thinking about it. And suddenly, there's this whole issue to worry about. And often the thoughts start to take a little, there's like a place where we know we're just thinking about it, and then we switch so it becomes our reality. I had a friend who had a lot of history with mammograms, you know, having a lot of cysts and having to go back to be rechecked. And she was putting off this mammogram. Finally, he scheduled it on a Monday. And she caught herself, and she was worried about having a positive diagnosis. And she caught herself saying to her friend, "I'm really worried about this mastectomy I'm going to have on Monday." And she had already jumped ahead. You know, I'm going to have the mammogram, I'm going to have a positive thing, I have to have a mastectomy. So she already jumped ahead of the actual reality of things. And luckily she caught it. She's noticed that. It's like a classic story is walking through the woods and you see a coil of vine in the distance. And you think, okay, it's just a coil of vines. But then you think, maybe the lighting, it's actually a snake. Okay, if that snake bites me and I'm too far away from getting help, I might lose my leg. If I lose my leg, I'll lose my job. If I lose my job, I'll lose my house. If I lose my house, I'll lose my partner. And it just kind of go on and on and on, based on this one sense data. And that's this thing called papancha, this proliferation of thought. And this is a key component of what makes worry happen, makes worry work. Right? So we have a thought and we build more and more thoughts around that. Thoughts trigger emotions, emotions kind of validate the thoughts, we have more thoughts, and it just becomes a very big, big process, a big storm. And there's a huge amount of suffering that comes from that. I mean, it's if you ever talk to someone or in the midst of that or you're yourself in that, you know how much suffering there can be. And not to discount, there's a core thing often of real concern, something that's really an issue. But there's all this other papancha that comes around it. The problem itself is actually, when you boil it down, it's fairly simple. Now, sometimes, we talk about a lot of our problems that we obsess about are first world problems. You know, am I going to get that job? Or am I going to be, you know, these different things that if you're in a more, like in a third world, you're much more focused on getting your basic needs met. And when you have a basic needs issue come up, often things are very simple. You know, am I going to have enough food tonight or not? Am I going to survive or not? And sometimes our life shows up like that. We have diagnoses, we have loss, that just is very clear. This is really what the issue is. Even within a mile radius of this building, there's many people who are in those issues of trying to have enough food to eat. But yet the sophistication of being in a first world culture creates much more opportunities for worry. So I'm maybe not worried about getting enough food, but is the food organic? Is it non-GMO? Is it going to affect my digestion? So there's more and more things that happen that we can worry about, more sophistication of worry, more things to be concerned about. And here's another key piece about worry, and really many of these patterns, is that we're constantly reinforcing them. Like much of the research now looking at neuroplasticity, if we keep going through a pattern, we make that mental groove deeper. So it's like a wagon wheel rut. And when they used to go through the plains, they go through the same place and make a deep rut. So it'd be hard to get off that, but it'd be easy to keep going in that same direction. So when we worry, we practice it over and over again, our minds naturally start to incline to that. We start to reinforce that. And the three things that we tend to reinforce it with are actions of body, of mind, and speech. The Buddha often talked about nutrients. So it's like the conditions that make something grow. Like if we have a seed, by itself it's not going to grow. With the right soil, with water, with sunlight, it can actually grow into a plant. It's the same thing with the hindrances and many patterns, both of ones that lead to suffering and one that leads to the end of suffering. There's nutriments that help support that. They help allow those to grow. in the numerical discourses of the Buddha. There's a sutta I was looking at in preparation for this talk. And one of the main nutriments of the hindrances are misconduct of mind and body and speech. So how we act, when we act unethically, when we act out of harm, you know, lying, things like that. They create a sense of unease in ourselves. Okay, a sense of, you know, having to look over our shoulder. We're not so settled because of those things that we've done. You know, so when you find yourself lying or being sneaky in some ways, you're not so settled. The more settled you are, the less worry arises. So getting a sense of getting your house in order. Sometimes as a particular person that may not be settled with, like a mother and their daughter or their son, things are quite clear, so there's a sense of worry that gets projected outwards. So coming to address really that core of unsettledness, worry starts to fall away. Yet many people, you know, especially in this tradition, don't have major ethical dilemmas or edges that they're fighting against. Yet still, their minds are plagued by worry. You know, why is that? Why is that? So remembering that mental actions also count. The self-negative talk, the sense of self-criticism, being a perfectionist, all those qualities are ways of misconduct toward yourself, harming toward yourself, and they create these deeper patterns of hindrance to arise. And this is actually a nice gateway into some deeper investigation into this pattern. Because when we look at when we're worried about something, you know, some events, some interaction with somebody, and there's a sense of unease around that, coming back into really what am I worried about? There's a sense of I've done something wrong that we often carry since we're little children. You know, it was engendered that somehow we're at fault, that we're about to get in trouble. And then as we grow up, we still carry that issue. So it's a psychological issue, but it's also very much tied into how we form the sense of self. It becomes a deep perspective, a forgotten perspective that's still very active in almost everything that we do, that shapes these patterns of the hindrance, shapes the patterns of the sense of self. So how can we work with worry? And how can we not worry about it? The first thing is to recognize it as worry. I always remember this when worry was up for me this maybe last year or something, just like sitting with it, walking with it, and just asking, you know, what is this? And when I recognized, okay, this is worry, just that sense of recognizing it created a shift. It's like with the Buddha, when he became awakened, he still had Mara kind of following him around, trying to trick him, trying to get him caught up in things. And he would say, okay, I see you, Mara. After a while, he would say, okay, I see you. It's like saying, I see this pattern of worry. I recognize this. When you're recognizing it, you're no longer so caught in it. When you don't recognize it, it becomes your reality, becomes who you are. So first recognizing it, and then there's this willingness to start to shift from the urgency to act, shift from the outcome or the object of the worry into the actual state of the worry. You get a sense of that? It's like the worry is like, let's say you're worried about the election. Okay, next Tuesday, if this person gets elected, I'm going to leave the country. And there's all this, there's a specific thing I'm worried about, and there's an action that comes, I want to come out of it. If I shift into the actual felt sense, the body standing in the middle of worry, that's a very different way of relating to it. So practice that this week. Practice shifting back into the body. Because worry is so focused on what needs to be done. There's an urgency that needs to be done. And often it's really distorted by the pattern. So we need to learn how to start to relate to worry as a state of mind, not a statement of reality. So again, there may be very real issues to deal with, but unless they're right in front of us, how much planning do we really need to do? You know, how much obsession do we need to do? If it's in front of us, then the action, we make the right choice, we make the wrong choice. So this quality also of remembering thought is very reactive, it very builds upon itself. And to have a suspending the belief in thought can be very helpful. It seems like the more vague the worry is, the more undefined, the more papancha that comes up from that. The less control we have over the situation, the more thoughts come up around it. And it really hijacks our ability to reason. Actually, one of the benefits of all the focus on science and mindfulness is that they actually shifts part of your brain that is used for reasoning, for higher level thought, that goes more offline. And you go more into the reactive parts of the brain. So a key way to do this is to ground in the body, to call your attention back again and again to what is the body reality in this moment. So you may be feeling the heart pounding. Remember once I was at Cloud Mountain waiting for an interview with Rodney, actually. And for some reason, I was just really nervous about it. And my heart was just pounding, and it was a very intense experience. But because it was the middle of a retreat, I could keep my attention on the actual experience of worry, of anxiety, without getting caught in what the story might be. Willingness, okay, this I have to go through this. I'm going to see what actually arises. So by being able to sit with it, to be still with it, as I was waiting for that interview, I helped to unhook some of the pattern of being so caught in it. That's one of the gifts of mindfulness. It starts to unhook those patterns, start to help to shift us out of those deep ruts of our mind. So having that confidence, it grows as the more we try it. The confidence to sit in the midst of this experience. This is a key precursor to really investigating it. If we can't sit in the midst of this experience, we're not going to be able to really understand it. We won't have enough attention, enough steadiness of attention to look deeply into it, to actually penetrate it. We're going to be caught in the reactivity. So practice in small ways. Practice in little ways of, okay, I'm late to this appointment. Okay, I can't change the fact the traffic's moving at this pace. Go into the sense of the body being worried. It can also be helpful when you go into the body is to realize that there's many things happening in this moment. Even right now in this room, okay, I'm talking, and maybe, hopefully that's the predominant thing in your experience. But there's also the sensation of sitting on the chair or the cushion. There's a sensation of the air touching your skin. There's a sound of the plane going overhead. There's a feeling of your breath. So having a broader perspective of what's arising in this moment helps to balance your mindfulness. Sometimes worry is so charged that we look at it and our mindfulness itself becomes tight. It gets kind of caught in it. All right? But if we keep coming back, feeling the sensation of worry, but also at the same time feeling like the warmth of my hand, the contact of my foot on the cushion, hearing the sound, seeing the sights in the room. That helps to balance our attention, helps us be able to be much more open to what's arising without becoming so caught, so obsessed in it. This allows us to start to cool this quality of worry. You know, worry has a certain heat to it, a certain intensity to it. That's why it's paired with restlessness and worry. It's very helpful to have a good dose of compassion. To realize, this is a painful experience that I'm having. It's painful to be worried, to be concerned. It allows the mindfulness also to broaden, to soften, to become more malleable, to become less brittle when compassion comes in, a sense of caring that this is a difficult experience. So once the attention is more balanced in this way, we're able to observe it without being so driven by it, so caught by it. So we can start to ask some gentle, open questions, a gentle way of investigating or inquiry. So these are questions that you ask that are simply highlighting the experience more fully. It's like we're learning to see what's the unconscious elements which are driving us. What's the part we have not woken up to which is driving this experience? And so with some patterns with worry, you know, what is this? What is present? You know, sometimes just recognizing, okay, I'm very afraid right now. I'm very angry right now. Just recognizing it and then coming again into the body sense. How has this felt to the body? Bigger context of the whole environment. Helps you to start to soften and relax with it. I don't know if this is a good analogy, but like if you go bird watching. I never had much of a taste for bird watching, just I wasn't very patient for it. But when you go, you don't know what's going to arise. And there's a sense of waiting and receiving it. Okay, sometimes you might see a really rare bird, and other times you won't. But there's a sense of just being available for what arises in your environment. So same thing, once the mindfulness and attention is balanced, we could become available for what may arise in our own mind-body. And a good guideline is as you start to ask these questions, you know, what meaning am I making of this? You know, what is present? You start to boil down the answer. You just keep asking it. The answers may arise. Images might come up. You keep coming back again and again to the question, holding yourself in the middle of your experience. And you find if you're on the right track, you become quieter and quieter in that. There's a sense of stillness that comes as you see those deeper questions arise, those deeper knowing arise. While worry gets more and more noisy, gets more and more caught up in thought, in story. So it becomes a very clear guide, which way am I going here? And so for myself, often I would work with a pattern like this. And this is, I'm not talking about doing this in a course of a 20-minute sitting. You know, it might be over a few months for a really key thing that's really strong, but just keep coming back with a lot of patience. And at some point, there's a shift that you have. You say, okay, this fear of this situation, of this relationship, is really a deeper, much deeper fear underneath that. You know, of survival, of being loved, of being approved of. And then once I recognize that, I keep orienting back to that deeper hurt, that deeper pain. Now, this is a psychological thing to do, but it's also showing, from right view, from the perspective of the path of awakening, you're starting to see the framework that you create the sense of self. The timbers that you use, the skeleton that you build worry on, the same skeleton you might build wanting on, or craving on, or dislike on. Right? There's a skeleton in there. And you start to see what are the bones that make up that skeleton. What's really the texture of that. Right? So you start to see that. And eventually you start to look at that framework itself. You start to reorient. When worry arises, instead of being distracted by the allure of the content, the allure of what needs to be fixed, the object of the worry, I reorient. Oh, this is a sense of self that's being triggered. That's a sense of self that needs to be understood. So then I go back and touch that, understand that. And then there's a sense, what happens if that is released? What happens if there's a sense of quieting that, of not constantly reinvesting in that? And then that becomes a gateway into the Dharma. All right, just sit quietly for a moment or two. Thank you. So we have a chance for some questions or comments. Anything that we can continue the investigation into this pattern of worry that came up during the talk, or things that you're confused about, really helps to kind of flesh out the talk and make it connect with your own minds, with your own life. Yes, David.
So you talked about investigating the framework.
Yes.
The conditions that give rise to the mind. You talked about the need to investigate that framework and its conditions sort of as a prerequisite to free us from anger. I guess my question is, I'm a little bit concerned that by investigating the framework and counseling back to that, that I'm sort of reinforcing it, or that I'm reinforcing the sense of self. It's like, I guess the question would be, can you explain that to me about how by coming back to that, I'm releasing it, not strengthening it?
Okay. So the comment is about this framework of the sense of self, that investigating it, the concern that it might be actually reinforcing it. So can you tell me a little bit more about what your sense of that? Because I agree with you, that's quite possible, but how does that show up for you? Yes. Okay, so there's a sense of when you see that common pattern that comes up around who you are, there's a secondary belief, okay, that's who I am, a conclusion about what you're seeing. Is that? Yes, that's really the only saving grace is just the sincerity of heart, is a willingness to recognize that. And the fact that you ask that, you're starting to see that there's a way that we can look at something, even the sense of self, that has a sense of self embedded in it. And if we look at it and we see that, we start to make more conclusions around it, more elaboration from it, then we're reinforcing it, right? On the other hand, if we look at it and there's a sense of the ground becomes less stable, there's a sense of perhaps a slight disorientation, a sense of like, okay, I'm not quite sure where I am in this, how I form in this. You're less certain about yourself. That's the right way to go. When you become more certain about yourself, when you go, I can tell you all about emptiness and this, then you're going into that sense of elaboration. It becomes very sneaky. It's actually kind of fun to watch how the mind does that. It's like it's almost like a virus that really embeds itself in the cells. So the cell no longer recognizes a virus in it. And so we're having this, so the immune system doesn't know that there's a virus in it because it looks like a cell. It's like the same sense of self. You might have a really clear seeing, and then the sense of self reestablishes itself through that very seeing. But it's not quite the same. And I think the best guide is that sense of really orienting yourself to recognize that deep stillness, that sense of quiet. That's, in some ways, it's not empty, it's not void, it's actually very, very rich. I don't know if that makes sense. So it's a very good question. I think it's something to keep coming back to and noticing. How am I reinforcing this? Right? And really, any time that you look at something and there's an opinion around it, there's an idea around it, there's a sense of it, of identification around it, a sense of, okay, I can label that, the sense of self is operating to some level. It's just how much do we invest in that? How much do we take that on and add more to that? When the sense of self is not so present or has fallen away, it's a much more direct, simple relationship to it. the thoughts around it, you can see that just a label that sloughs off like water off a duck's back. Okay, thank you. Yes, Anne. Yeah, you know, I wasn't super definitive, like, this is the key. I kind of mumbled through that part, so that's probably why I didn't quite go in as well. But, and I'll say what I said, but before I say that, I want to encourage you to find what works for you. And that's kind of the creative part of this whole practice, is that sometimes you hear a teacher say, okay, like, who am I, or what is this? Or Norman said one that was, you know, who is this? It's kind of different phrasing. Sometimes one of those phrases just really, it opens you up. It takes you to a certain direction. So there's a lot of creativity to just see. And kind of the components of these questions is that it's a question that doesn't have a elaborate answer. It's like okay, I can write a book now about this answer to this question. That's shifted off. It leads you to a direct understanding of this moment's arising or falling away. So simply like, what is this? You know, what is present? It can be a very helpful one. Just in general, when you're caught in some kind of state, I just, you know, I know I'm not peaceful. I know I'm not calm. I'm not settled. I'm just, something's going on. Okay, what is here? You know, just to recognize that. What meaning am I making of this? Something that Christina asked on a non-residential. You know, what meaning am I making around this? How am I making myself around that? Does that help? Do you need any more? Yeah, I think, you know, if there's, a lot of it depends on which direction your practice is going. What I mean by that is really what area is alive for you right now? So like, let's say worry is, okay, that's really what I want to focus on. Then there's a particular questions that may help with that. If it's really about opening the heart and connecting with love, there's a different question that comes up. And it's natural for that to change over time. It's like you have this gateway that you work for a while and you open to and you deepen. And at some point it becomes a little stale or a little routine. And then you switch to a different one. But as long as there's this deeper intention that it's like a fire that keeps growing and growing, then things will work their way out. Yes, Krista.
I remember once Rodney said that we misconstrue worry for caring. And it sounds like you're offering being present with as the caring versus the worrying.
So the comment was that she heard Rodney once say he confused worry with caring. And I'm offering a different thing of worry, like that actually being present is a form of caring.
Right, and that worrying doesn't really help at all. It doesn't help your kids, it doesn't help your situation, it doesn't help.
Yeah, so the comment is, you know, does worrying really help at all? Does it not help at all? And I think that's a good thing to notice. You know, does it really serve a purpose? You know, it's like you can really worry about, it's like when I became a parent, it's like this whole new thing, set of things to worry about I never thought about before. It's like, oh, you know, there's pedophiles and there's poison apples and, you know, there's witches with their baskets. But it's like there's that sense of when we care about someone or care about something, there's a natural concern that comes out. And there's actually a point of wisdom in that we know that no matter how much we care about something, we can't control it. We can't make things perfect for them. We can't stop impermanence. We can't stop impermanence. We can't stop the fact that that person will die, that I will die, that they will experience pain and suffering and loss. I remember my daughter, when she was really young, she lost something, like a sticker or something, and she was really upset about it. And there's a part of me that said, okay, I wish I could make it so you never would cry about anything again, you know, as a father. And there's another part of me that realized, this is actually good to learn. She has to learn to navigate through life. Because life is a constant series of disappointments and joys, gains and losses. Yeah, so the sense of obsessing about it, the sense of trying to figure it out and worry about it, it creates so much unnecessary, like that quote I started with, 9/10 of what I worried about, the worst things never actually happened. Right? And it actually has this effect of freeing us up to be much more responsive to when our actions really are needed. You know, if we're not so caught up in the worry, we recognize this is really the invitation to help, to really show up. And what's really needed? Is it just being silent and listening to them sob? Is it, you know, getting them some soup? Is it, you know, holding them? Is it going out and talking to the teacher about that bully? I mean, there's many different things that arise, but we can trust that our hearts are clear. There's a clarity that comes. It's like, think about also when you've acted and just very clear, this is what needs to happen. How much worry led to that? It's like, yeah, zero. Yeah, I'm off it.
I have a question about the utility of that going to the body. For worry, it seems like one strategy is distraction, or making rules around if it's nighttime or I'm tired or I'm sick, that's not good.
Yeah.
Those are times I don't get to worry. I have to wait until I'm ready to do it. And then maybe a rule around if I'm going to have the energy to worry, I have to do something other than worry. So that's one strategy that seems like it might have an analogy to the body, where you were saying it gets you out of the cycle of it. The point was more like there's an opportunity with the body that's beyond just calming the fire obsession. I'm interested in trying to go there. What else is there other than distracting from the obsession?
Okay, so the comment or question is about using the body as a way to connect in the midst of worry. Is there something more than just calming down things so you can see? Is there actually a utility to that in itself? Is that, or besides like distracting yourself from the worry? And actually it, as you said, it has when a huge effect of going to the body, it does tend to calm things down. Instead of going into the papancha of it, the elaboration of it, we're able to come right into the present moment experience. Right, so that's huge because it stabilizes the mind. But what your question is there an actual benefit to observing the state of worry in the body itself? And I think there is. Yeah, very much is. Because worry, I mean, especially when... It's like worry is such a somatic experience. You know, it just has so much tension and so much charge that we can actually really track in our bodies. And by learning how to track it and recognize it, it becomes this other source of information that starts to become available for us. You know, when I'm talking to somebody and I'm kind of finding myself saying a lot of things really quickly, and I tune into my body and realize, oh, there's worry here. And then there's that recognition that, okay, I need to attend to this worry or speak this. Or if I'm hearing someone talk about a plan of action and there's a sense of worry that comes up, you know, that's kind of the messenger of that, the healthy part of that. Okay, I'm not quite settled with this. And then I act from that. So it allows us to really, one, really experience worry, really what does it actually feel like, you know, in the body. And by doing that, also you start to, you know, realize just how costly it is to ourselves to be carrying that. So that's another benefit, that we realize, okay, we don't want to keep doing this unnecessarily. The body it's important to mention here too that the body isn't always a refuge for people. You know, the body, for me, it's always been a really big place of stability, a place of grounding. But as I've grown into this teaching role, I've realized that for some people, because of past trauma or pain, abuse, when they go into the body, suddenly it's like there's like putting gas on the fire. That suddenly there's this huge sense of being overwhelmed by things. Sensations just get too much. So that's why it's important to realize the purpose of the body is to ground us in the moment, understand things. And so sometimes that grounding needs to come like with sound, or with sight, or a part of the body that's comfortable. So it's always looking at how pliable is that mindfulness. Okay, once it's pliable, then the very connection with the body can become a learning. You can see, you know, the patterns of arising and falling away. You know, as I see an insight into the worry, that the deeper roots of that, I see a corresponding relaxing of that knot in my belly. But for some people, we need to work into that gently. We need to work into, you know, finding a place of stability that they can really ground into the moment in a safe way. That's in some recovery. Yes, Linda. So the comment is about worry and how really so much of our lives, can't control, that's unpredictable, and how does worry relate to that? In some ways it's that could we, if there's a few people getting up, if we could try to sit still till the end just because it's a little distracting and you know, sometimes we have to catch a bus or something, but as much as possible, try to keep the container of the evening till 9 o'clock. So the unpredictability of life, I think that's, if we look at, we start to get really down in the nitty-gritty of things, really the deep roots, that's often the solution the self, sense of self puts on things. You know, it's like I keep trying to if I can't control life, so I'm gonna keep reforming myself. Even though that sense of self keeps falling away, I just kind of ignore that fact and keep really doing it. So that's from that very kernel, that core of that sense of self reinforcing it, then we build a whole pattern of worry. If I think about all the different possibilities, I can somehow have a sense of control. But underneath, there's a deep sense of not being in control. And so that's kind of this almost existential, fundamental fear that we have as human beings. Is that, you know, I don't know that my house is still there. I don't know that tomorrow will bring what today brought. You know, if we really look at it, there's no guarantees. That has to be balanced, though, because if we get too much in that, we become, you know, depressed, we become despondent. The other side of it, though, is if we release the expectation of things, we're available for the actual spontaneousness of life. We're able to participate in the arising of that moment. If we're not controlling it, we release the need for it to be a certain way, we're able to actually be with it as it is. So there's a sense of surprise, a sense of aliveness that comes with that. So that's what I would say about that. All right, thank you.